From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello and welcome to The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
We'll devote this episode to Alessandro Volta.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, we're going to measure volts. Well, actually, we're going to measure a lot more than that because we're going to talk about voltmeters, right?
Right.
I mean, everybody should have at least some sort of voltmeter, but they come in a variety and they do a variety of things. I have one, and it measures current, resistance, voltage. It's a multimeter, as they used to call it. Or maybe they still call it that. I don't know. But, yeah, there are quite a few out there.
There are. And I guess multimeter is a very descriptive term. I guess it sort of overlaps with the term I'm more familiar with, which is a VOM, which stands for volt, ohm, milliammeter.
Yes.
Which are the three things that the earlier multimeters could measure. The newer ones can measure more things. But I think you're right. Every ham should have at least one VOM or multimeter. These kinds of things have been popular for at least 80 years. My first one, which I got, I think, in 1967, is still going strong. It's part of the Simpson Model 260 series family. And they've been making them since 1939, 80 years about, and they're still in production.
We had something in QST not too long ago about the Simpson meter.
Right. And they're a classic, but
they are.
But they're still as they do everything they used to do just as well as they ever did it.
Yes.
And they're still very popular, and they're still in production. So, interestingly, they're made exclusively by the people, the Simpson people, or whoever owned the company, sold it to an Indian tribe. And they're made actually by an Indian tribe. I forget which one.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I read that
okay.
When I was looking into this topic discussion. But anyway, it doesn't matter where they come from. Wherever they come from, they're very useful and very good. They're based on an analog electromechanical measuring device invented by Darsenval in 1882. So the idea is not terribly new.
No.
That's before radio. It's an electromechanical movement that uses a permanent magnet surrounding a small coil, applying a voltage or actually a current through the coil, results in a magnetic field there, and that causes the coil to shift on some bearings, which moves a needle. And you can actually read the current on the scale behind it. And they typically have a native internal scale capability of about 1 milliamp for a full-scale reading, although sometimes you'll find them more sensitive than that. And then what the VOM does, it actually switches in shunt resistors to measure higher values of current. So typically you'll find one that reads a milliamp and 10 milliamps, 100 milliamps, and up to often 10 amperes. And then they also have an AC-DC switch, so you can it'll rectify AC, and
yes,
and you can measure AC volts or DC volt DC current with that. And then by having a series resistor, you can actually use it as a voltmeter, and that's built into the switching function. And in addition, by having a battery inside, you can measure the current through an external resistor, and that allows you to measure resistance. So all of those things happen without you having to think about it. You just look at this front scale, and you say, I want to measure the R times 10 scale, and you measure a resistor, and you look for something that's fairly near the middle of the range so you can get a good eyeball reading on it, and it works fairly well. The limitation of them, as particularly as voltmeters, is because they use the energy of the applied signal to move the meter. They actually load it somewhat. So it actually is not like a transparent measuring device that has no effect on what you're measuring.
Mm-hmm.
When you apply the meter leads to something, you're actually putting a resistance across that circuit. The typical VOM of that sort is specified as having a sensitivity of 20,000 ohms per volt. What that means is if you're on the 2.5 volt scale, you're measuring voltage, the resistance that the meter applies to the circuit is 2.5 times 20,000, which is 50,000 ohms, and that means you're applying a 50,000 ohm resistor to the circuit. Now, if the circuit is a fairly low impedance one, you won't notice the effect of that. But
no.
If you're measuring something that has a high resistance associated with it, chances are applying the meter will make a difference to what the actual voltage is. So you have to take that into account. And the higher the sensitivity, the less likely that is a problem. Now, in recent years, the volt ohm milliammeter or multimeters have tended to come with digital displays.
Yes.
And usually the circuitry in them does not have that limitation. The circuitry has a high enough impedance that it almost won't make any difference. And of course, everything makes a little difference, but it won't make much difference when you apply it to the circuit you're trying to measure. You don't have to think about it. VOMs with digital displays have a lot of advantages. They come with different price points, have different numbers of digits, which makes a difference to the resolution you can read. Notice that resolution and accuracy are not quite the same thing, but you can measure smaller differences with a digital display than you can analog. And they also have the advantage that the digital display, while you can certainly break one, they're less liable to be damaged by rough handling than the analog meters, because the analog meters have a very fine needle-type suspension that everything sits in, and if you hit it hard enough, you can force the coil right out of its suspension, a real project on your hands to get it all back together. It probably won't be successful. But the digital meters also allow measurement of other things that are, because of the circuitry involved, it's easy to pack in a whole bunch of other functions. Some of them measure capacitance, typical analog VOM. Some of them measure frequency, some temperature, and both they can do it internally within the meter itself, but even more useful is and this I guess could happen with a analog meter too, you can have a probe that you can put it in on equipment and actually measure the temperature of some circuitry to see if it's getting too hot. So there's a lot of flexibility in the digital ones. They're available in a number of sizes and form factors. So some of the smaller ones are very compact.
They'll fit right in your pocket.
In your pocket. I have one in a compartment of the boat that sits there all the time, another one in the toolbox, and there's some that are big and sit on the bench, and there's some in between. So they're all kinds of sizes and shapes and prices. There's no reason not to have multiple. You don't have to decide, do I want an analog one or a digital one? Get one of each, because they're comparably priced at this. You know, they have price points, similar price points for different quality levels and so forth. The typical lower cost digital meter might have 3 digits of display, which allows you to read it about as well as you can read an analog meter. To 3 digits is about as well as you can do with that. But some have 4 or 5 or more, and sometimes they can store values. Sometimes they can, I have one computer interface in case I somehow want to memorize everything I do with it, which hasn't happened yet, but it could, I guess. So there's all kinds of things you can do with them and a lot of different capability.
As a veteran technician, you and I both, I think we qualify, right?
I believe so.
There's one thing about analog meters that I enjoy versus digital meters, and that is being able to see a rate of change. Do you know what I mean by that?
Absolutely. I meant to mention that, because that's a big advantage a lot of people say for analog meters.
Yes.
If you're adjusting something, tuning something, like the S meter on your receiver, if you have an analog meter, as you tune and you're tuning for maximum, you can watch the meter go up, and then it hits a peak and it starts to come down. You can very carefully move it into the maximum value. I find that much easier to see than, even though the digital meter might give you more significant digits, seeing digits change value doesn't give you the same sense of what's happening, at least to me, as watching something move. So
at the rate at which it's happening.
That's true.
And that can be important.
Yep.
I mean, if you're watching a final amplifier transistor go into thermal runaway, it's kind of handy to see that needle peg over on the...
Yes, yeah. You see something. It gets your attention much more than saying the number is now 7 instead of 5. You know, so what does that mean? So that is a big advantage, and that might be a reason to have one. Some digital meters try to simulate that with a bar graph, but oftentimes the response is not quite fast as it would be with an analog.
No.
And you can actually sometimes hear an analog meter when it goes all the way over.
You hear a tick or a clunk. Yeah, yeah.
And people talk about wrapping the needle around the pin. Well, you can do that too. It's a one shot measurement. But
well, Joel, I have one more question for you. However, before we do that, let's take a break and hear from DX Engineering.
Ever talk to a salesperson who didn't know the difference between a rotator and a rotary phone, or a Yagi and a yo-yo, or a Balin and a ballerina? You'll never have that problem with DX Engineering. When you call us, you'll talk directly with knowledgeable amateur radio experts, people who speak your language. When you contact DX Engineering, you're dealing with operators who are as passionate about the hobby as you are. This means better service, expert technical advice, and a commitment to your complete satisfaction, even long after your purchase has been made. Whether you're newly licensed or a longtime operator, you'll always find a friendly ham who understands exactly what you need on the other end of the line. Plus, you'll find a huge selection of amateur radio equipment, get the fastest shipping in the ham universe, and shipping is free on most orders over $99. Let's talk about your station. Visit us at dxengineering.com. That's dxengineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. And I wanted to address in VOMs or multimeters that one unusual feature that many of them seem to have, the transistor test function.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Or diode test function.
Right, that's...
I haven't used that myself, but...
I have on occasion, and I guess, you know, we always used to do it using an ohm meter in the old days. You can do it separately and check each junction and apply a volt. You know, you can simulate it yourself.
Some of them have little sockets
they stick
the transistor into. Yeah.
Of course, you have to know what the pins are and so forth, which is not always a trivial thing to find out. But yes, that's a good point. I must admit I haven't used that a lot, but I'm sure it's a very effective way to do it. It's easier than taking separate readings on the emitter-based junction, collector to emitter, junction, da-da-da-da-da, and seeing what happens. Touch the base, resistance changes. You can do it with an ohm meter, but you have to keep track of which polarity you're using and so forth. So
since I've never done it, how does it work?
Well, it just applies the appropriate voltage, and it I think you can measure the forward current transfer ratio. I mean, you apply a current on the base, and you look at what happens to the current from the collector to the emitter. And that tells you the forward current transfer ratio or beta. And that really tells you a lot about what the transistor will do with that particular voltage. Now, presumably they have to do it at a fairly low voltage and current because it probably applies, you know, they don't have separate setups for different transistors. I don't, it's kind of a lowest common denominator, but it'll tell you if it's working, or which is a good thing to know. I mean,
especially when you're trying to troubleshoot something, sure.
Now, a diode is pretty straightforward. You apply a voltage to it, and if you get current through it, it's conducting, which it should only do in one direction. So you try it in one direction, you reverse the leads, try it in the other direction. By the way, it's always good to check and see which terminal of your voltmeter in the ohms position is the positive one. Good to know that. Now, on one of mine, it's the positive terminal. On another one, it's the negative terminal, because not positive and negative for the resistance measurements. They don't say that. But the voltmeter connection and the current meter connections, same connection, have usually a positive red lead and a negative black lead. And that's the way they should be hooked up to measure something. But when you're measuring resistance, many times they don't think about that because the resistor doesn't care. But when you're measuring a diode, it does matter.
Absolutely.
So you use another voltmeter to check your voltmeter on resistance range to find out which side is actually positive, side is negative.
And speaking of the resistance range, something I've done from time to time, I'll be measuring a resistance, and then I forget to turn the switch on the voltmeter to the off position, because of course when you're measuring a resistance, it is applying a voltage and a current, and if you don't take your voltmeter to the off position, or unless you're blessed with one that will go to sleep automatically, you'll run down the battery.
Well, that's very true. There's another more subtle thing that I found out about many years ago. If a analog voltmeter, multimeter, is set on a voltage or resistance range, in addition to the problem of running down the battery in the resistance measurement capability, which it'll only do if the leads are touching, by the way.
That is true, yeah.
There's almost no damping on the meter. The meter will swing very freely. If you're on the volt, or actually if you're on the current range and the leads are touched together, when the meter tries to move, it actually tries to generate a current to run it through the short that's there, and it's hard to do, and it actually slows the meter down. Now, the point of all this statement is when you're transporting it, if you put it in the highest current position, which on my Simpson is 500 milliamp range, I think, put it on 500 milliamps, it has noticeably less meter needle movement when you shake it than it does on any other range. So that's the position to put it in when you take it in your car to go measure something or carry it up the stairs to measure something in the backyard. So there's a best place to put that. In addition to not being on ohms, also put it on milliamps.
Milliamps. Now, my meter has another cute feature that I end up using quite a bit, and that is what I would call, I guess, the continuity buzzer or beeper.
Oh, yes.
And many times I just want to know if I have an electrical path between, say, one point on a circuit board and another. I will use that. I switch it over to that function, and if there is continuity between those two points, I hear a beep, you know, when I touch the probes. And that's really handy, too.
It's handy, and it's also a safety feature. Because what it means is, if you want to find that out and you're working on something that has high voltage someplace else, if you have to look in the equipment, put the meter probes down, and then look, turn your head and look at the meter to see what's going on, you might move your hand and actually get in contact with something.
Yes.
So this way, you don't have to look at the meter to find out what's happening.
Well, they have some meters now that have voice annunciators. They will actually read out with a voice what the voltage is. You don't have to look at it at all.
I tend to turn those things off. But I can see that actually it would be helpful in that case. I guess I don't talk to my car. My car doesn't talk to me. I don't talk to any of that stuff. No, that's a good feature, and I think it's fair to say you won't find that either of those on most analog meters.
No.
But you will find some variation on it on most digital meters. So it's another benefit on the column of the digital side that you can get that.
Do you think the digital meters will ever completely replace the analog meters?
I do.
You do?
I do. Just okay. Because...
I didn't expect that answer.
Well, you know, I guess that's off. I didn't expect the question, so we're even. So I didn't think about it a lot, but I, you know, while there are a lot of benefits of an analog meter, it is possible to make a digital display that is an exact duplicate in form and function and view of an analog meter. I just reviewed a transceiver that has such a meter on the front panel.
I own a transceiver with just such a meter on the front panel.
And unless you look at it carefully from the side or take it apart and try to find the needle, you realize it's actually a... I wouldn't call it a digital display. It's a, you call it a liquid crystal or some kind of one of the display technologies. And it actually simulates an analog meter perfectly. That the ballistics of the needle and everything are down to a science. It's just nicely
it'll
done.
It'll actually bounce.
You know, some digital representations of meters just look like digital representations of meters, and they aren't quite as good. But what I'm getting to is this kind of display technology is getting less and less expensive, more and more common, more easily done, and there's no reason somebody wouldn't come out with perhaps starting out at a fairly high level but coming down in price over the years, meter that has both a numerical display and an analog meter display of the type that's in your radio. And at some point, that price will cross over that of building a carefully manufactured and constructed by hand, no doubt, meter movement.
So I wouldn't be surprised if those meters were already out there, but as you say, at a high-end price.
Yeah. Remember the first calculator you got, the first scientific calculator you got for $500? Yeah. anyway, they're now $5. So, you know, that's the trend. So I wouldn't be surprised to see all the benefits of an analog meter built into a meter that's also a digital meter. That's just my personal guess about how the industry works.
I suspect you're right. Are you ready for a question at this point?
I am.
Okay, we have a question from Scott, AG7FF, and he's asking, with a fan dipole, you can feed antennas for several different bands with a single coax at a single feed point. Is it possible to feed two separate antennas with feed points in different spots with a single coax and a T adapter, for example, a 20-meter vertical and a 6-meter Yagi? That's an interesting question.
It is, and people ask this fairly frequently. The answer is maybe. I mean, here's what it comes down to. The guiding principle of why you can operate a fan dipole is that two or more antennas are such that the impedance is very high on the frequencies of each one is very high on the frequency of the one that you're using. So if you have an 80 and a 40-meter dipole and you hook them to a coax cable, let's say on 80 meters, well, let's take the 40-meter first. On 40 meters, the 40-meter dipole will have an impedance that's fairly closely matched to the 50-ohm coax. The 80-meter dipole will have an impedance of... because it's full wave, will have an impedance of a couple thousand ohms. So almost no current will go into the 80-meter dipole. It'll all go into the 40-meter dipole and get radiated. A little more complicated on the other arrangement, the impedance of the 40-meter dipole on 80 will be very low resistive but very high reactance and probably have an SWR of 30 or 40 to 1. Almost no power will go into it. It won't be quite as obvious a number as with the other arrangement. But in that way, the current coming up the coax is sort of directed because of the impedance of the different antennas to the proper antenna for the band that you're using, which works just fine. Now, any current that goes in the wrong antenna is not too big a deal either because it's typically parallel with the other one, and it'll radiate in the same direction, and who cares, you know, which antenna the signal came from. If it's going someplace that you want to talk to, it'll all be part of the signal that gets there. But most of the energy will go to the proper antenna. Now, that's the parallel dipole or fan dipole case. In your case, you have a much more complicated situation because while the impedance of the 20-meter vertical, let's say, is just right on 20 meters, perhaps, and it will be very different on 6 meters, so if you were connected right at the same point, the current would go in the proper antenna. The problem is you have a piece of coax going from the bottom of the 20-meter vertical to your T-connect. On 6 meters, it'll be some complex impedance at that point, and it will not be matched to the coax. But as it goes through the coax for some distance, it'll actually be transformed by the mismatched coax to some other impedance, which may or may not be favorable to what you want to have happen. Chances are it'll be fairly high SWR. And then you have the opposite problem on the other band. So it's not as straightforward. And what will happen is, let's say you do split the current split the power. So you're operating on 6 meters, and some fraction of it ends up going to the 6 meter or to the 20 meter vertical. The results are not as benign as in the other case.
No,
because presumably you have the 6 meter Yagi because you want to have a directive antenna. You want the signal going in a particular place. Well, any radiation that comes off the 20-meter vertical will tend to negate the benefits of your front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, and, of course, reduce the gain in the direction you're trying to put it. So what you'd need to do is very carefully determine the impedances of everything on the opposite band. So, you know, what is the 6-meter antenna's impedance on 20 meters after it's transformed through the length of the coax getting to the T-connect?
Oh.
And now you could also measure it, by the way, with an antenna analyzer. So you can actually do this. And once you know the relative impedances and you can figure out how much of the power goes to which antenna on each band, then you're in a position to say whether or not you can actually hook them together in a T-connector and get the results you want. But it's not obvious to me exactly which way it'll go. Yeah, for example, with your 40-meter or your 80-meter dipole on 40, if you happen to have a quarter wave matching or quarter wave length of coax from the 80 meter dipole that you were going to hook together with the 40 going through that length of transmission line will transform that to an impedance not that far from the impedance of the 40 meter antenna, or at least it'll be possibly resonant and it'll be relatively low impedance, and you may end up having more energy going towards the wrong antenna than you do to the right antenna. And if they're pointed in different directions, you might be surprised on who you talk to. So, but there are other ways to do it, and I guess in place of a passive T-connector, you could get a remote coax switch. And that's a very handy way to do it. It costs more than a T-connector. And typically they come, I haven't seen any that just switch between two choices, typically four or more.
MFJ has one that will switch between two.
A remote switch?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. So there is one. And but even if you got four, sooner or later you want to add more antennas. So it's always good to have room for expansion, I think. You can't have too many antennas. Some of the coax switches can be powered through the coax. You don't even have to run additional wiring. You just put it there in place of the coax T-fitting and switch it from the shack. You have to be careful that any lightning arresters you have will pass the DC a little bit, but that can be taken care of. So that's one thing. There's another thing you can do is to use a diplexer. They're not terribly expensive. I think they're less expensive than the coax switch. Many of them are designed to separate 2 meters from 70 centimeters, which is a lot easier to do.
Yeah, those are popular.
Very popular for two-band VHF antennas and two different radios or vice versa. But there was one I saw for about $60 that will separate 20 and 6 meters, exactly your case, with a specified loss of 0.2 decibels and a power handling capability of 600 watts. So your antennas could work just the way you want, except it'll be a little more clever than just a benign T-connector.
Absolutely. Thank you.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.